Hello and welcome to the opening bell. My name's Matt Christie. This week I'm joined by art editor Nick Bond to discuss all things in the world of boxing. It's been a bit quiet since the Deontay Wilder fight, but we did have some action last weekend in London as Kevin Mitchell, not for the first time in his career, looked very, very impressive in a world title eliminator. It was Daniel Estrada who stopped in 8 rounds. A lot of people are getting quite excited, Nick, now that maybe Kevin Mitchell has put it all together. But I mean, I remember when he looked good against Bridey Prescott. He looked exceptional against John Murray, becoming the first man to stop John Murray. And then the next step along the journey, it kind of went wrong for Kevin Mitchell. What do you think is going to happen next?
It's a pleasure to be here, by the way, Matt.
And it's a pleasure to have you on, mate.
Pleasure to be John Dennon's understudy. Mitchell, yeah. He's had some very good wins, but he's also disappointed, isn't he? I remember the Ricky Burns fight. He disappointed there, and obviously the Katsidis, he was overwhelmed by him at home at West Ham. But he's looked to be maturing now, and he's looked to, you know, be finding the best form of his career, really. He looked really good on the undercard of Scott Quigg, do you remember, at the XL. When Scott Quigg fought the Cuban, Kevin Mitchell looked really good then, and he's kind of built on that, especially with the Maduma win.
Okay.
And now again against Estrada, he's maturing and he's hitting some form. He said that his last win was his best of his career. He's going to have to improve on that if he wants to win a world title.
Okay, I think I agree with you. What do you think went wrong? I mean, there's no secret that he hasn't always knuckled down in training, but if he couldn't, you know, there has been suggestion that he didn't take training camp as seriously as he should, particularly against Michael Katsidis. I remember being there for the post-fight press conference there, and Mitchell and his then trainer Jimmy Tibbs pretty much admitted as much, that it was kind of a chaotic build-up. Mitchell didn't take it seriously. What will have changed now, do you think, that he will take a world title seriously?
Well, I think Mitchell, he's 30 now. He's certainly maturing, and with age comes maturity. He won the ABAs as an 18-year-old featherweight, and there was a lot of buzz about him back then, and his pro debut, there was a lot of buzz. He was still 18, 19 when he turned pro, and people expected a lot of him then, and you know it would be easy for him to take that for granted and believe the hype. But now he's quite mature in his career now. He's getting into the veteran phase, and he's had a few losses, but now he seems to be taking things seriously, as you say.
If he does put it all together, because I mean, for me, he's one of the most naturally gifted fighters we've had in Britain for quite a while, one of them. But you never can quite know what you're going to get with him.
He's not been consistent.
But do you think that if he puts it all together, if he is at his best, as good as he can be, training camp has gone well. We're told that he was back in the gym on Monday following the Estrada win, which is really, really encouraging. But let's imagine that he does everything as he should in the lead up to what we presume will be a world title fight, which will be his next fight. And the guy being spoke about is Jorge Linares. How much of a chance do you give a peak top class Kevin Mitchell against someone like Jorge Linares?
Well, Linares, in many respects, his career has taken a similar path to Mitchell, because when he turned pro and burst onto the scene, there was big things spoke about him. He was the next golden boy. There was a lot. He would be the new prospect. Everyone would look out for him. But he's fallen at the hurdle a few times, been beaten, been stopped, and now he appears to have found a bit of form. I think Mitchell, on his day, like we said, he would have to improve on his performances. When he's boxed at the highest level, he has been found wanting. But if he can improve on the Estrada win, then he can beat Linares. Linares isn't invincible. He's been stopped. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that Mitchell could win.
Is there a chance, though? I mean, we're kind of pinning a lot of things on the fact that Mitchell didn't prepare properly for Katsidis. Perhaps he didn't prepare properly for Burns. But is there a chance, though, that actually he was as good as he could have been against those two guys, and he's just reached his level. He's not destined, and he hasn't got it in him to be a world champion.
Well, yeah, we won't know, will we? At the time, that certainly looked to be the case, but the last sort of four or five performances, he's looked really good, and they have been the best of Kevin Mitchell. So if he can build on that, then yeah, he can win.
Okay, someone that has delivered time and time again at world level, a British fighter, is Karl Froch. This week, he did what a lot of people expected him to, in that he vacated the IBF title. He keeps a watered-down WBA belt. It means that the James DeGale fight looks extremely unlikely. He stated that, you know, perhaps when he's back to form, when he's got over this injury, and if DeGale goes on to win the vacant crown, that perhaps they could meet in the future. But reading between the lines, it looks like Froch DeGale isn't going to happen. Let's focus on that first of all, rather than the implications of him relinquishing the title. Is it a big miss for British boxing that Froch will not fight with DeGale, presuming that's what doesn't happen?
It is, but Froch doesn't owe us anything, really. He's cleaned up domestically. He's been the best or thereabouts at his weight for a long time. I mean, the DeGale fight would only happen in Froch's eyes if there was something to fight for, and DeGale doesn't really bring much at the minute. He's high risk, isn't he? Froch wants to see his name in lights in Las Vegas, and I think he's earned that, so fair play to him. You know, if he fights Chavez or Hopkins or whoever it is, he should take that fight and then, you know, be content with his career. He doesn't owe us anything.
I agree with you. I agree with you there. But this situation, although let's emphasise...
I mean, let's make no mistake, he's not avoiding DeGale or anything like that. There's no question of that. Froch is doing what's best for him at this point of his career. You know, DeGale would be a tricky opponent for him, but you'd expect Froch to beat him.
Ambrose Mendy was at the press conference which announced that DeGale will fight for the vacant title.
Yeah.
And it looks likely that it will be Andre Durrell. Negotiations for a potential April 25 showdown are underway there. But Ambrose Mendy said something along the lines of that Karl Froch had the chance to prove he was a great fighter by taking on James DeGale. It didn't mean that he had to beat him to become a great fighter, but in order to accept the challenge of the younger man, and the fact it seems that he hasn't done that, he could be affecting his greatness. What's your take on that kind of line of thinking?
Well, Froch's response to that would be clearly that he destroyed the man who beat DeGale. He beat the best domestic opposition in George Groves. He beat him comprehensively. I don't think... it's not really an argument, in my opinion. I think Froch has got bigger fish to fry. I mean, that's not taking anything away from DeGale. He's certainly at that level, but he doesn't bring enough to the table to tempt Froch into the ring, you know. That's just the way boxing is. You've got the old guard and the new guard, and Froch has earned his stripes, and he should be able to do what, to a certain degree, what he feels is best for him.
A lot of people have kind of drawn parallels with Steve Collins' retirement, when he didn't fight Joe Calzaghe. In turn, they've drawn parallels with what happened at the end of Joe Calzaghe's career when he decided to move up to light heavyweight and not fight Karl Froch. I would strongly suggest that both of those cases were very similar as well, in that I really don't think that Collins was avoiding Joe Calzaghe, nor do I think Joe Calzaghe was necessarily avoiding Karl Froch. I think it's a very, very similar situation. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, once these guys get to this level, as with Collins and Calzaghe, they've come up the hard way and they've had success at the top, and they got out at the right time. If Froch gets out now, or he has one more fight, then fair play to him. He's nothing left to prove, and they certainly had nothing left to prove. There's nobody saying that Froch would have beaten Calzaghe. I think you can make more of a case for Calzaghe beating Collins, but that's another conversation. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if DeGale's done as much as what Froch had done, or what Calzaghe had done at that stage.
I think he probably has, to be honest. I think he probably has. I think he has beaten a few worlds. Although, I mean, Froch had been with a few.
Froch was probably more advanced.
Calzaghe perhaps not.
Calzaghe went into the Eubank fight, didn't he?
Yeah, but
there was talk of the Collins. Yeah, but Collins got out at the right time.
The one thing, I mean, but I do. There's something in Carl Froch's autobiography where he kind of not too harshly criticises Joe Calzaghe for taking the Bernard Hopkins fight. Now.
He's talking about.
Now he's down, talking about several years down the line. Could that come back and bite him?
Smell the irony in that.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been a massive fan. I've got to be honest. I've never been a massive fan of the Froch-Chavez matchup. I'm not sure quite. I always think Chavez has been overwrought. However, the Froch-Hopkins fight to me is a puzzling one, particularly after Hopkins will be coming off a terrible beating. He's probably lost what, three times since Calzaghe fought him.
I think neither Chavez or Hopkins are there to enhance Froch's legacy. It's more about Froch, not that he needs the money, but having a good payday and fighting in America, fighting in Vegas. He needs an American opponent. He needs someone that the TV stations will be interested in. And Chavez and Hopkins tick both boxes. Although Chavez is Mexican, but he's
Mexican. Jack Hirsch made... Jack Hirsch is our American correspondent, regularly contributes to the magazine and to the website. Sometimes his opinions are a little bit out there, but he kind of breaks down what the options are for, and bear in mind this is a view from America from Jack Hirsch, very experienced writer. He breaks down various options that could potentially be on the table for Carl Froch. One option that he champions is a rematch with Andre Ward. The first fight wasn't a classic, despite the scorecard. You would say that Froch was fairly comprehensively outscored. But if Ward is coming off a long layoff, Froch's form has certainly been impressive since. Can you see where Hirsch is coming from? The blog, by the way, is on the website. It's worth giving it a read.
I don't see Froch improving on that performance last time out. I actually quite like the Chavez fight. I think it would be an attractive fight. Chavez is hittable, but he's tough, and he can fight. You know, he wouldn't be where he is if he couldn't fight. Hopkins is a spoiler. Andre Ward, you know, he's very skilled and all the rest of it, but he doesn't make for attractive fights. I think TV wise, Froch Chavez would do good business.
Okay. And one last question on Froch. Let's, if we can, and let's plant ourselves in an ideal world. Let's forget how old Carl Froch is. Let's forget what he's already achieved. Let's just look at his style. Let's look at what he brings to the table. If you could just pick your ideal opponent for Carl Froch, who would you like to see him fight?
Well, it'd have to be Golovkin, wouldn't it? He's the man of the moment. There's so many fascinating fights that Golovkin could appear in, and he would present a good challenge to Froch.
Okay. Right, let's... I agree with you. I agree with you. Most of the things you've said there. all right, let's move on to... Well, there's a big anniversary coming up next week on February 11. It will be the 25-year anniversary of when Mike Tyson lost his invincible cloak forever. Buster Douglas was the man who took it from him, rather savagely and completely shockingly. This week in Boxing News, we focus on that fight, and also we speak exclusively to the other four men, and also Douglas, who beat Tyson, Evander Holyfield, Lennox Lewis, Danny Williams and Kevin McBride. Let's go back to 1990. You and I are of a similar age, Nick.
Yes.
So... I was approaching my 13th birthday.
Okay.
I remember. I don't think we had Sky, and I think it was on Sky. We didn't have Sky in the house at that point. I remember reading bits and bobs about the fight. I had also seen Buster Douglas lose, almost capitulate against Tony Tucker. And I felt that Buster Douglas had had no chance really. And I remember getting up the next morning, at that age, I was very, very excited to go and look at Teletext and see what had happened. And the headline was something along the lines of Douglas shocks Tyson, which I couldn't believe.
And shocks the world.
Yeah. And it was just, it was absolutely stunning to me.
It was huge.
At that age. And of course, then you had the whole thing going on with the supposed long count, which was kind of delayed the inevitability of Douglas's coronation. But what, do you remember it? Do you remember how you found out? Did you manage to watch it?
I don't think I watched it live. I mean, we're going back a long time here, aren't we? It's hard to cast your mind back, but it was absolutely shocking. I mean, for a lot of people are in denial over it, and probably still are, with you know, relating to the 10 count or the supposed long count that Douglas had. But it was shocking, and yeah, I mean, it was, everybody was stunned at the time. It's hard to remember it now, but
did you think that Tyson was going to go on forever?
I think we all did, but there were hints. I mean, looking back, there were hints that things weren't quite right with the whole Tyson camp, especially his marriage and his personal life, and to be a professional boxer and to be at the top for that amount of time, those kind of things don't need to be there, or will cause trouble. So looking back, maybe not so surprised in the end, but at the time, you know, we all were. It was shocking to even see him lose, you know, subsequent fights to Holyfield, because even then we kind of thought he was still invincible, but obviously it turns out he wasn't.
It's a really fascinating story from the beginning to the end of Mike Tyson's career. Was really, really absorbing stuff. You know, perhaps one of the most engrossing tales in boxing history.
They're talking about a film, aren't they? The people behind Boardwalk Empire are talking about
it's good people to get involved.
A Mike Tyson film, which would be sensational. I think Terence Winter, the guy behind Boardwalk Empire, is also involved in The Sopranos. That would be interesting.
It's easy to criticise Tyson for the way in which his career kind of collapsed so suddenly and so dramatically. But we had Nassim Hamed on in the podcast last week, and he was a world champion at 21. He goes into a bit of detail of what that feels like to be world champion at such a young age. But certainly speaking personally, I mean, let's also remember that Mike Tyson, when he turned professional, was 18 years old. He was had a fantastic reputation, a massive prospect at the age of 19.
Yeah.
If I look back at what I was like at that age, I think I'd have found it very, very hard to stay on the straight and narrow.
I think we all would have, but I mean, consider Tyson's background, and that makes it even worse, doesn't it? I mean, a guy who came from, well, almost poverty, you know, in trouble, in and out of detention centres and all the rest of that, and to be in that amount of money and that amount of attention at that age, it would have just been mind-blowing.
Do you think that it would have been any different? I mean, there's always a lot of discussion about what happened, obviously, his trainer Customato passed away, and I believe in 1985, the end of 1985, Tyson then kind of went on with Kevin Rooney, Jim Jacobs and Bill Kane was still involved. All that started to unravel in around 1988, 1989, Don King obviously involved.
Robin Givens.
And the trainers all also changed. Some of them had been around the Catskills, but some had not, and it all kind of got a bit chaotic. But do you think Tyson was always destined to implode, or do you think that if he'd have had the more familiar team around him, they could have kept him on the straight and narrow?
Who knows?
I mean, Danny Williams says something here that, you know, perhaps he could have gone on to beat Rocky Marciano's 49-0. Do you think that was a possibility?
I mean, who knows? But if I had to give you a one-word answer, it'd be no.
Yeah.
Just the character that he is. His style and everything about him just, it didn't scream long career at the top, dominant guy. It just didn't. He was explosive and brilliant in his prime. He had trouble with certain styles, but, you know, no boxer's perfect. I don't think he would have been a dominant Larry Holmes type reign. It just wasn't in his makeup.
Okay, that's interesting.
What do you think?
I think his character, which was probably ingrained in him before he got involved in boxing, was always likely to.
I mean, the point was that there was so much turmoil. He lost so much people that were close to him in Customato. It's an interesting question, and I don't think we'll ever know, obviously, but.
Yeah, and he did lose. He lost Jim Jacobs as well, didn't he? And it was all. It must have been all very, very difficult.
Yeah,
to try and
look how would Don King have played into this? You know, his personal life. I mean, as he got older, you know, he would call the shots more, and yeah.
When he was focused, he was an incredible fighter. I mean, I think Daniel Herbert, who incidentally was ringside for Mike Tyson's first world title win against Trevor Burbick in November 1986. He's put together a interesting 10 count kind of rating Tyson's best wins. We've all kind of answered the question as well in Heroes and Villains this week, but for me it was possibly the win against Tony Tucker, where he did show there. I remember he got rocked in the first round. Tucker had belief for the first half of the contest. Tyson found a way to win that one and win it quite handily in the end. I think that showed when he was focused what he could do. He also obviously had the destructive power, which accounted for a lot of his victims. I don't know, there is something that you sense, besides that Tony Tucker fight, which is perhaps, you know, really, really searching his win record for something where he faced adversity.
Yeah, Tucker was unbeaten at the time.
Yeah, but every time someone kind of fought back, he struggled,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, certain people say Tyson was a bully, and as with most bullies, when they sort of come up against resistance, they capitulate themselves. He's a fascinating guy.
Where does he rank in the best of all times? Does he merit a top 10 place?
Oh yeah, certainly. But you know, if you look at the very best of Tyson, he matches up to anyone. But as a career, it doesn't quite match up. So it just depends on what your criteria is. But certainly, without doubt, top 10 on his night. You know, he would have beaten or come close to beating anybody.
Really? That's
on his night. Yeah.
Yeah.
But as a career, look at his career, his body of work, it doesn't match up to Muhammad Ali, for example.
And that question that so many people are asked, who wins Muhammad Ali 1966, let's say, against Mike Tyson 1987-88?
If I was a betting man, it'd be Ali for sure. But yeah. Tyson, you know, Tyson was an incredible fighter.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. Okay, so what else is going on? Oh, of course, Manny Pacquiao, Floyd Mayweather. You were on the podcast 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago?
Something like that, yeah.
Nick, and I asked you to put your life, if you had to put your life on it, and would you, to whether Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather would fight this year. I think you did end up putting your life on it.
Well, I can't remember what I said.
But you did. I forced you into a corner, and your response was that they would fight.
Yeah.
Has anything changed in the last two
or
3 weeks?
It looked increasingly like the fight would be made. There was the meetings. There was a meeting at the basketball game. They had the meeting in the hotel room, and quotes were coming out. Bob Arum was saying that, you know, there was just a few things in the contract to iron out. It was just down to TV stations, HBO, Showtime, and then nothing happened. And then Mayweather's gone away on holiday and accusing people of lying. It's a bit of a soap opera.
So do you think that it's going to go ahead?
It's not looking likely, is it?
I don't know. I really don't know. I feel like it's been going on.
If it's going to happen in May, they need to announce it pretty soon, because a fight of that magnitude will come with a whole lot of promotion. It'll be a juggernaut, and they need to get that rolling. Whether it happens in May, I don't know, but it could happen. It could happen later in the year.
Who would you think they would fight if they didn't fight each other?
Well, there's talk of Mayweather having a rematch with Miguel Cotto. That's been spoke about. Who knows? Who could Pacquiao fight?
They're talking about Jesse Vargas for
Pacquiao.
For Manny Pacquiao, which...
It's not a great fight, is it?
No, it's really not.
Yeah, we had all these great fights lined up, and you know, ultimately we could end up with none of them.
It's a real shame because, yeah, a few weeks ago it was feasible that
we may get Canelo Cotto
and we may get Mayweather Pacquiao.
Yeah.
Okay, feasible, I say. It wasn't, perhaps likely would have been too strong.
It'd been spoken
about, certainly feasible. But there is, I mean, also, I tell you, we haven't spoken about on the podcasts is Deontay Wilder. I think when we last spoke, he was about to fight.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, he was about to fight. So, really, Nick, you haven't had your moment in the sun. You're definitely the only person that I was aware of. You're certainly the only person in boxing news to pick Deontay Wilder to win on points against Pumain Stiverne. Most people were picking Wilder, obviously going for a blowout within five rounds. What was your thinking behind Deontay Wilder, Pumain Stiverne points win?
Well, there's no experts in boxing. I think we all know that. The fact that Wilder had not boxed anyone quite as good as Stiverne. I knew Stiverne was relatively tough. It just had points win for me. I mean, Wilder had been knocking over these guys who were really nowhere near as good as Stiverne. Not that Stiverne is the second coming of Muhammad Ali, but it just didn't seem that he would bowl him over. I mean, it wasn't a largely confident pick, but it's just how I felt the fight would go.
I think you're being too humble.
Thank you. I mean, there's no experts in boxing. If everybody could pick every fight, then you know nobody would watch it. Yeah, we'd all be loaded.
We'd all be laughing all the way to the bank.
Exactly.
So, heavyweight division, Deontay Wilder, Tyson Fury is a good fight, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. I mean, that's who he wants to fight, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not an easy fight to call. Fury represents something that Wilder's probably never boxed, and probably likewise for Fury. It's a difficult fight to call. You know, probably slightly favour Wilder. I'll have to give that a bit more thought.
Okay.
How do you see that one?
I don't know. I think perhaps I'd favour Fury.
Really?
Yeah, I think I'd favour Fury.
I don't know. I'm not as big on Fury as perhaps some people are.
I think he's a bit wiser in a boxing ring. I don't know. He's quite tough. But the thing is also that we can't forget is that massive right hand of Deontay Wilder, and Tyson Fury swallowed a few right hands in his career. And
there's no doubt it would be an entertaining fight. So
yeah, I think in terms of just pure entertainment, I'd rather see that than Wilder against Klitschko.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, it could be quite painful
for Wilder.
I think it would at the moment. I definitely think it would at the moment. But you know, give it. I think the most promising thing with Deontay Wilder is not what he's done so far. It's just the signs that he's making of what he might go on to do.
Yeah.
In that he is improving and he's ticking boxes as he goes.
How old is he now, Wilder?
29.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's not old for heavyweight. I mean, what do they want to do? Wait till Klitschko hits 40. What, he's 38 now, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he doesn't beat Klitschko on Klitschko's best night, for sure. Yeah, wait till Klitschko gets old, but I don't think Klitschko will outstay his welcome as a boxer. I think he's going to wait, perhaps get Wilder, get the WBC belt, and then walk away. What's left for him to prove?
It's true. Let's, before we go, is there anything else we need to discuss?
WSB.
WSB, yeah.
Yeah.
So you went along to your call last night.
Yeah, I mean...
What's your opinion on WSB? Because it's...
As a concept, at first it was something new and people didn't really understand it. There's a lot of boxers who perhaps shouldn't be in it. It's strange that you might get a Bulgarian, for example, like last night, boxing for Britain. But it does make for some good fights, and you get to see the very best boxing the very best. So, you know, we've got the Cubans and the Russians are in the British group, which is just great. I mean, it's great to get them in York Hall. We had Lomachenko came over a couple of years ago as part of the Ukraine team to box Sam Maxwell. And that was amazing to see him in York Hall and Bethnal Green. I think it's a good concept. I mean, I'm not so keen on the APB. I think that just muddies the waters, but the WSB, there's room for it.
Okay, it's not the concept that has caused controversy. It's generally the classification, in that it's not counted on people's professional records, although...
It's like a professional fight.
By all intents and purposes, it is.
5 3-minute rounds, no head guards. Yeah. They are, for all intents and purposes, professional fights. But these top amateurs that they train like professionals now anyway. They're funded. They're full time boxers. It's not what it used to be anymore. It's not like amateur boxing was. So it's kind of created its own criteria, its own sort of platform with these elite amateurs. And now there's this tournament where they can box each other regularly, and we can all see it.
Okay. Do you think there is an argument to be made that perhaps they should form part of a professional record? I mean, if you imagine, I mean, I accept that they haven't officially turned professional,
yeah.
And I accept that it is a kind of a competition nature, but however, so is things like Prize Fighter,
yeah.
For example, which does turn up on professional records.
Yeah.
Do you take that on board?
Yeah, that's a valid argument, if it is an argument. Yeah, they are like professional fights. I mean, people said when Lomachenko officially turned pro that he had boxed X amount of WSB bouts, what was it, 4 or 5, and won them all, obviously. So should that be counted on his record? But I don't know.
But you enjoy, the next one is in 2 weeks' time, isn't it, against Mexico? Is that right?
Yeah, the Mexicans come to York Hall in 2 weeks' time. I think meanwhile, the British go to Cuba, which would be tough. I mean, I think they're good, entertaining night of boxing. You know, they don't go on forever. There's only 5 contests, 5 3-minute rounds. You get some good class. Yeah,
I think, I can't remember who it was. Did he go to one last year or the year before?
I remember you went to one. Yeah, I think that was when the Kazakhs came. The Kazakhs boxed the British team. That was a good night.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Yeah. I did enjoy it.
You get the right team over. I mean, the Algerians, who the British beat last night, were really not at that level. There was one good boxer. Same with the Chinese. They brought one good boxer, and the others weren't as good. But when you get the Cubans, the Russians, the Ukrainians, the Kazakhs, they're all a good standard, and they all make for good nights.
Okay.
This is John Dennon's territory, so I'm sure he'll tell you more.
Yeah, no, I've spoke to John about it before, but it's always good to get your take on things. You know, your experience on, you know, from both sides is always great to share, I think. Let's finish on one final thing. There was a birthday this past week. Oscar De La Hoya.
Yeah. I think it was 42.
Bit of, you know, he's had his critics over the years. In fact, Rita phoned me up the other day and was talking about Oscar De La Hoya and saying that, you know, he was overprotected in the early days. And ultimately, although he eventually kind of fought pretty much everyone he could have done, he lost all his biggest fights and perhaps shouldn't be regarded as highly as he is now.
De La Hoya is a divisive figure, I feel, and I'm sure you feel. It just depends who you talk to. I mean, to say he's overprotected is not really an argument, because they were talking about him turning professional against Genaro Hernandez, the late Genaro Hernandez, and fighting for the world title in his first fight, and that was, what, back in 92-93. Obviously they didn't do that, but I think he won his first title in his 14th fight. Jimmy Bredell. Yeah, he boxed everyone. The two guys who they could have, the fights that didn't happen but maybe could have, would have been Vernon Forrest and Winky Wright, but, you know, I think he did box everyone. I think Teddy Atlas says that Oscar always lost his, you know, his biggest fights, but, you know, beat Ike Quarty, it was a close fight. The Vargas fight was a big fight. The Trinidad fight was one that he lost, but it wasn't what you'd call a clear loss. It was a sort of a controversial loss in the fact that Oscar appeared to throw it away. The second Mosley fight, for sure, it appeared like Oscar had done enough. The Mayweather fight, Oscar was well past his prime and, you know, probably deserved a draw. Yeah, I mean,
love how you call him Oscar.
Yeah. No, he did box everyone, you know, he fell short, but, you know, nobody's invincible, as we found out.
He
fought Bernard Hopkins, didn't he, and that was just mad in hindsight.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he turned prior at super featherweight, didn't he, and to fight, end up fighting Bernard Hopkins is pretty amazing. He was the biggest name in the sport for about 10 years, wasn't he? Sort of the mid-90s onwards. You know, had he been born 10 years later, I think he would be a massive star now, what with social media and that kind of thing. He would be huge. He'd be bigger.
Did he fulfil his potential? Could he have done more?
I don't think so. I think he did just about what he was set out to do. Olympic gold medalist, which is amazing. All those world titles, all those big fights he gave us, the Julio Cesar Chavez fight, you know, the first one, and yeah, I mean, Oscar did a lot for the sport.
Out of all those losses that you've, sorry, I'm, you know, but out of the losses, which one?
I think
which one do you think will bother him the most?
I think the hardest one for him was when he lost to Trinidad, because they were both unbeaten at the time. And what, let's face it, was a massive, massive fight. It was a mega fight. These two, pound for pound, you know, unbeaten welterweights, you know, it was not quite Leonard Hearn's level, but it was certainly up there. And I think he took that bad. And then the rivalry with Mosley, the first Mosley loss, was big for him. Obviously, both Californian boxers, LA boxers, whatever. That was a big loss for him.
What about the Mayweather loss? Because that was quite a heated build-up as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think Oscar's... not many people expected him to win, I don't think. You know, he was past his prime. He was, what, 33, 34 years old. He'd been at the top for a long time. Yeah, that was a big fight. That was the first 24/7, I believe, on HBO. Mm. Now, I think if you look at Oscar and a couple of those decisions he got went... that perhaps he shouldn't have got, some people say, and there was decisions that he didn't get that perhaps he should have got. You know, it all evens out over the course of his career. I think we look back fondly on his career.
Do you, I mean, you speak about the close decisions. There were, you know, there was the Felix Sturm.
I mean,
the first one that springs to mind. But, I mean...
What fights he won that people question?
Yeah, but I think perhaps there was more that he... didn't win, where you could make a case for him winning. I know
certainly
Trinidad.
Certainly Trinidad, certainly the second Moseley fight.
Certainly second Moseley fight. Few people, including former editor here, Claude, had the Mayweather-De La Hoya fight all level, didn't he?
Yeah.
So let's say that fight was scored level and say that he beat Moseley in the rematch and he got the decision against Trinidad. How much higher would he have been in our Boxing News Top 100? Because incidentally, I believe he was at about 82.
Yeah, I think at least 20 places higher. I mean, if he'd have beaten Trinidad, or if they'd given him the decision against Trinidad and Moseley in the rematch, and Mayweather, he would be, much, much higher. But it's amazing that, you know, that's all it takes. Just in the Mayweather fight, in the last round, if two of the judges gave Oscar the last round, if the other judge had agreed, then the fight would have been a draw. So it just came down to that one judge and one point stopped that fight being a draw. I had money on the draw, by the way.
I bet you did. Do you think, but at the time, because obviously from speaking to you now, people that didn't know will probably know now that you're quite a big De La Hoya fan.
Yeah.
Rightly so.
Yeah.
Did you think that he deserved a share of the spoils in the Mayweather fight?
I probably did at the time. I mean, it's interesting though that he wanted the rematch. They wanted to make the rematch, and he boxed Stevie Forbes as a warm up for the rematch, and Mayweather decided to retire. I'm not here saying that Mayweather avoided him or didn't want to fight him, but you know, it's worth bearing in mind.
Yeah, but he didn't look great, did he, against Stevie Forbes there? Yeah,
well, I think he won every round, didn't he? But
a lot of facial damage, I seem to remember that he.
Yeah, he won every round. He threw a lot of punches. Forbes was a tough little pro, wasn't he? Slick as well.
And let's let's wrap it up. We'll just talk about the Manny Pacquiao fight.
Which fight?
Manny Pacquiao, Oscar De La Hoya.
Okay, yeah.
I remember when it was announced. I think I was working for KOTV at the time. And
December 2008. Yeah,
I remember it was kind of being rumoured for quite a long time before that. And I remember when I first was kind of heard that they were considering it, I thought it was absolutely preposterous, and I thought that De La Hoya would walk through him.
Yeah, as did a lot of people.
Were you of that?
I think so. Yeah, Pacquiao had never boxed at welterweight, had he?
No. He'd only boxed, he hadn't boxed at light welterweight.
No, he just demolished David Diaz with a hell of a knockout, hell of a punch. You know, Oscar was also a big guy fighting at light middleweight and middleweight. It wasn't the right thing for him to do, to boil himself down to welterweight. And I think Pacquiao's team knew that, Freddie Roach in particular. And Freddie Roach always says that when the referee was given the final instructions in the first round, that Freddie Roach saw the intravenous marks on De La Hoya's arms where they'd been rehydrating him in the dressing room before the fight, and he told Pacquiao to go and jump on him, and that's pretty much what he did for 8 rounds, whatever it was. It was a painful night for Oscar, for sure. He showed a good chin, though. He's always had a good chin.
I was never really... Well, I say I was never a fan of Oscar De La Hoya. I always appreciated him, but he was never someone that I would have necessarily called one of my favourites, but I did find that a particularly hard fight to watch.
He took his lumps, didn't he?
That loss to Pacquiao. There were quite a few rumours, as there always are when people with names of that magnitude, when they retire. There was quite a few rumours of a comeback afterwards. Do you think if he'd have gone back and, you know, fought at a more natural weight for him at that point in his career, say like middleweight, he could have come back and gave a better showing, maybe gone out with by beating a champion? Or do you think
post Pacquiao,
or do you think the fight was really taken out?
I think the fight showed that he didn't have it left at that level, and I don't think that somebody who'd boxed at that level for so many, many years should or would drop down a level. You know, he didn't need the money. What's the point? You know, you're risking your health. I think he quite rightly retired. I mean, let's not forget that, you know, his lightweight days, he was electric, wasn't he? When he walked through Rafael Ruelas in 1994, that was just sensational. he was probably at his best around 10 stone, I'd say.
Okay. Well, let's leave it at that. Nick, I really, really appreciate you talking to me. Hopefully you'll be back next week.
Back to work now.
Maybe...
Oh, by the way, we've got a new Instagram page at Boxing News Online. Check it out.
Check it out. Yeah, no, there's some really good, images up there at the moment. But yeah, thanks as always, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back next week.